Southeast 28th Avenue and Ankeny. Right. So Allison, thank you so much for being here. Welcome. I'm so excited to have you.
Thanks for having me, Amanda. I'm excited to be here.
So I wanted to ask you a couple of questions just to start out. Just a day in the life of a printmaker, that is Allison. You know, when you have a studio day, how do you stack your time?
Sure. Well, first thing, I always start my day with coffee and snuggling with my two cats. But then I do like to get into the studio early. There's something sort of nice about being in the studio in the morning when it's quiet and it feels sort of like a special time. So I like to, you know, start my time in the studio. I'll like listen to podcasts often as I work. And, you know, generally a lot of my practice is centered around letterpress. So the first thing that'll happen will be setting type to print or redistributing type from earlier projects. So that's sort of how the day gets started.
Mm-hmm. Very hands-on, more physical experience.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and sort of taking it from there and inking the press and starting to print things and experiment a little. I'm hands-on and I'm pretty experimental about it. I don't always go into go into the day knowing exactly what it is I'll be working on. I'll have lists of phrases that sort of have drawn me or I'm interested in doing something with, but I won't always go into it knowing exactly what I'm going to do with them or mm-hmm. what the end result will be.
In the moment, yeah. What inspiration strikes you from your notebook? So how do you build up your notebook then to what you would carry it with you all the time, I would imagine, and are writing down phrases and things that you hear?
Yeah, I definitely write down things that I hear or see or, you know, things that strike me. Sometimes there's just, you know, there's just some interesting phrase that pops up. I definitely, I also have several projects going where I'm directly taking phrases from specific source material. In the past, I read interviews with people who have had extraterrestrial or UFO experiences and directly pulled from those phrases that I thought were sort of interesting and evocative. I've got an ongoing series that pulls from things that Donald Trump has said that, you know, sort of investigate his odd use of language. And then for my show that's up at Wolf Gallery right now, my primary source material was the TV show The Bachelor.
Wonderful. So let's talk about that exhibition at Wolf Gallery that's up right now. It is text-based work that's presented in various formats that ranges from just, you know, a print, a letterpress print, but it also incorporates video work and mirrors too. Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk about how you choose the platform that you're giving these words and if it adds, you know, basically, where do you draw the line?
Sure. And that's, as I watch the show, I take notes on different things that I'm hearing that sort of sound, you know, sound like something to me. I also have read transcripts of the show and have pulled from that. So I have, you know, in terms of how I was approaching this show and this body of work, I just have stacks and stacks of different sort of possible snippets of things that could turn into future work. And since the work in the show is, you know, is presented in a variety of formats, many of those I've sort of experimented with in different forms. I think that the letterpress work reads very differently from the work on mirror, and they, you know, they have different strengths and they mean different things. So that was definitely something that I was thinking about and working on. It's difficult to say how you know. I think that's sort of
just the artist instinct.
It's just that feeling. You do it and you say, yes, this is working, or no, this is not working.
So the letterpress, for our listeners, the prints, they're typed out, they're set, and then there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of repetition in each image for the most part. I mean, how many times do you, are they all multiplied?
Not all of them are. That's another, you know, that's another thing where sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, sort of the individual phrase and what I feel is sort of best expressing the feeling that I'm trying to go for that specific work. But I do very often print, you know, overprint things, print things on top of each other, or, you know, giving it some sort of movement in that overprinting. Mm-hmm. I'm using a lot of different forms and formats within this show, and that was a real primary concern as I worked on this, is what would best express each of these sort of individual feelings or, you know, specific work, given that I'm using both letterpress and animation and text on mirror, as well as small lightbox pieces. And I guess it ends up coming down to feeling a little bit. I would play with different phrases in different ways and see, you know, sort of see what fit the best. But specifically, I noticed while working on the mirror pieces that those need a certain type of phrase. That work is very specific, and anytime that you're seeing yourself in a piece, it's a very specific experience that changes, you know, changes a lot with the type involved.
Mm-hmm. And for our listeners, these are mirrors that have mirrored vinyl text overlaid onto it. So you can read it, but you're also, it's a mirror reflection. So it's
right.
Yeah, it's a very immersive experience and like very honest. It feels to me like when you're looking at this, and also if you're going to the exhibition, which I highly would recommend, taking a trip to the bathroom at Wolf Gallery. And that sounds a little bit strange, but maybe just trust me on that one.
right, because there's a piece in the bathroom as well.
Yes, so don't miss it.
Yeah.
And also one of the coolest bathrooms probably in Portland.
That's true. It was a real treat to put up a piece in there.
So there are the light boxes that you make for these, or do you make the light boxes yourself?
I have help constructing the wooden frames for them, but then I'm putting them together myself. So yeah. They are, you know, they're sort of deep wooden frames that have a light at the back, and then the front is letterpress printed on Japanese paper. And oftentimes with this work, the there are multiple layers of paper involved as well, so you end up with this sort of it's sort of like an atmospheric perspective that can happen, because when you stack the layers of paper, there's sort of this blurriness that happens in that layering.
It does have a very ghostly effect. That's a really great piece of information. I think people looking at it will have that impression, but it's also an unsettling feeling, like you're not sure how you recognize what you're seeing as being multiple layers and like have a little bit more depth, but it actually is. And with the light shining right through it, it adds that maybe repetition in a different way.
Right.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit also about repetition, because that's something that is, you know, very prevalent in your work with the text and the letterpress prints. For our listeners too, there's they're typeset and then physically moved around, so they're very concrete in a concrete poem way. And, you know, very visually striking, and it amplifies the text that you're using. So you were saying earlier how the text for the mirrors have to have a very, they call to themselves out probably a little bit. They have to fit this certain vibe,
right,
for lack of a better word. And so I also just wanted to tell our viewers too that about the show that you have that you're participating in Seattle Alone, that is curated by Vignettes and Grandma Seattle. Mm-hmm. And it's a series of billboards around Seattle and also a couple of window fronts. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that process and how long you were working on that? And text for billboard is certainly like quite different from a bathroom mirror in an art gallery in Portland. So that's a huge platform. And what was the process there, and especially relating to the show that you were working on for Wolf?
Sure. And that was its own exciting process. I knew that I wanted to do a billboard piece for this show. You know, the show is conceived of as a as a collection of public works that are available to people in Seattle for the month of May. So they're temporary public works that are meant to be seen alone in public and become sort of part of, you know, part of the landscape in a certain way. So I knew I wanted to make billboard work, and I've always loved art billboards. I, you know, just, oh gosh, they're incredible.
So always a treat to find them.
I know. So I knew that that's what I wanted to make for this project, just immediately. But then I found that a lot of what working on that show was for me was really just thinking about what a billboard is, because, you know, I'm familiar with this text-based work. I've been working in letterpress for many years now. It's, you know, that's something that I feel very comfortable in. But when I started thinking about putting these things on billboards, I realized that I needed to be very specific about what that was, and that, you know, both at this scale and in a landscape, it was different, but also that the billboard itself is, you know, becomes part of the piece. So people look at a billboard and they think it's an advertisement. I mean, most billboards are advertisements. Yes, yeah. And so rather than trying to fight with that and or pretend like it's not, you know, it's not part of that form, I eventually realized that how I needed to be approaching it was, what is it that I want to be advertising? Yes. So, you know, so what I ended up sort of coming to with that is that I wanted to be advertising this sort of sense of feeling things in your own body, something, I guess, sort of something towards your own experience of things and an emotional experience of things, and just how that could turn into something on a billboard.
Yeah, that's everything is change was one of the phrases that you picked, and I loved how it fades in and also out, and that just like really resonates. And so when I can imagine lucky people in Seattle stuck in traffic under that billboard.
That's been a nice thing to think about. Like I've really enjoyed thinking about the people for whom these billboards are on their everyday commute. So they spend an entire month just, you know, looking at this or not, and it becomes part of their life to some extent. So it's a special feeling to sort of become part of people's lives in a way that they maybe, you know, didn't deliberately seek out, which is, I think, different from, you know, different from the typical role of the artist, basically.
That's true. That's true. You're more of a producer maybe in this way. Which weirdly ties us back around to The Bachelor. Can I do that? This is a really that was a reach, maybe. But the phrases, so The Bachelor has been on the air since the early 2000s. It's a very enduring show. It's got, you know, massive viewers, massive followers in that they participate with the show outside of the show. And so I'm wondering, you know, you don't have to tell me how long you've watched it or anything like that, but do you notice certain characters that continue, like, or types that get cast maybe, and are there some types that give you a little bit more material to work with in that show, or have, I guess, at this
point? Sure. And I think that in a certain sense, The Bachelor is the same show every season, but with a new cast of characters. It's like a play production that is interpreted slightly differently by different production companies, but remains to some extent the same. It's very consistent in a lot of ways. And I definitely, the moments in the show that interest me the most are the moments when a contestant has been told that they're going home and they're being interviewed in the car on the way home. Mm-hmm. And people usually cry, and they're usually talking about you know, about how this is terrible and this always happens to them and they're never going to find love. And it's this like really emotionally raw moment for these people. And it's also the thing that I find the most compelling about the show. Cause I have to say, as a viewer, I mean, these people have pretty good lives. They're going to be okay. I have no doubt that they will have successful dating lives after they get off this show. I'm not, you know, I'm not worried about them emotionally. And so instead, it's just looking at this moment of sort of emotional rawness that you're being allowed into. And that's very interesting for me.
Yeah. In a setting like reality television, what moments that are genuine that peek through or that are allowed to peek through
right.
in the final cut that we do get to see.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent, maybe not even peek through. I think the producers are trying to get people to this point of emotional rawness that, you know, they know that we, the audience, want to see people vulnerable in this way.
Yeah. That also reminds, so the rawness and the emotion of reaction versus the act of watching TV or reality TV and the escapism that we get from that, how does that play into your work at all? Is that something that you think about, like, as a viewer, as you're making it very active by making work out of it? But it could be the opposite experience where you could just watch it and check out for 3 hours a week. And instead you're turning it into something very productive.
Right. And it certainly didn't start out that way. I mean, I started watching this show several years ago in Juan Pablo's season, for any fans listening. And I was sort of compelled by the show, and I wasn't sure why. And it took me, you know, I think it took me some time to sort of look at that and realize that maybe there was something there that I was interested in looking into. And then I think it was sort of a surprise when I started playing around with the work that ended up turning into this show at Wolf, and realizing that when I took these things that were being said by characters on the show out of context, that it had this deep emotional resonance to me, because when I was watching the show, it doesn't feel emotional to watch. It feels, you know, I think I'm probably watching it with a level of ironic detachment, and it doesn't seem like something that is particularly heartfelt in a way. But to sort of discover that maybe this is lying a bit beneath the surface, or that some of the things that people are saying are things that can have a life beyond this show was an interesting one for me.
Yeah. Walkie's the one that I have no idea what I'm going to do, and it's printed on the letters are facing opposite directions, and then they're radiating out from a point, and that's just a very, I don't know, it's the cry in the car at the end of the episode. It's like a very real feeling that you feel that you don't think about that much. And
yeah, but I mean, that's a universal experience. I mean, none of us are that constantly certain, you know. And that's sort of what's been interesting to me about watching it and about pulling these phrases from it, is sort of finding these things that point to vulnerabilities that I think people tend to keep to themselves more often.
Yes, it's a nice way to open up a platform that everyone's familiar with, and printmaking, people are familiar with mirrors. People are, you know, you look at yourself and then you look a little bit deeper sometimes, maybe when you have that experience, maybe with the art in the gallery or art in the street, in the billboard.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that there's something too with the mirror works, that it's we're really familiar with looking at ourselves in the mirror, you know, I think most people do every day, but having the text on the mirror in that way where you can still see your own reflection, and the text itself is not obscuring the reflection but is changing the reflection, you know, that can be a pretty intense experience. I think it was something where the first time that I tried doing that with a piece, I was surprised by the impact of seeing it and seeing myself immediately reflected in that work. So yeah. Slavoj Žižek has this idea that one of the things that is interesting and unsettling about watching television is the fact that your most intimate feelings are, he says, radically externalized, and that you're laughing and crying through another. And I think that that's almost perfectly fitting to these scenes in The Bachelor, that to some extent you're watching someone cry on television as a way to avoid crying yourself. It's, you know, it is this emotional experience that involves no labor on your part.
Yeah. You're a spectator to the feelings that you are feeling, and that right. that it's eliciting too, probably watching a show about people finding love and loneliness and the loneliness that they've been feeling.
Right. Right. And it's funny because I think that the love story is actually the least compelling part of The Bachelor, you know? And when you think about it, there's so many contestants on there and they're only going to end up as a single pair. And so it's less of a love story and more of a series of breakup stories, which are way more interesting and I think way more relatable. The love story is sort of banal.
Yeah. And the breakup stories are very relatable. I remember being in the gallery with the exhibition when it opened on First Friday, and the row of prints in the back particularly was eliciting a lot of a lot of relatable sad sounds and yeah. a lot of I've felt that before, a lot of recognition. And so I think that's the part of the experience of the media, you know, watching a show like The Bachelor and then also examining it through these really isolated points, through these phrases that when you're listening to it, when you're watching it, you do glaze over a little bit. But given the platform and with in the shadow box with the light behind it, it adds that level in your consciousness that you're like, oh, I didn't associate that before with these feelings.
Thank you. Yeah, that's been sort of an interesting thing about putting a show together too, is that it's not just, you know, it's very quickly it stopped being about the show despite the fact that the show was the source material, and it started being instead a way of sort of approaching making work that was emotional in a way that was, you know, was sort of an interesting starting point for me. And there's one piece in the show that's vinyl lettering on wall, just on the wall directly, that says that thing that you're supposed to feel, and it's in glitter letters. And that was one of those. Thank you.
And made me laugh.
That's perfect. Yeah. That's perfect. Because that was exactly it for me. I loved that phrase, and it had been popping around in different ways in my work, you know, as I was working on this show. And I just, that can be attached to so many different things in life. And there's such a pressure to be feeling the right thing at the moment that you're feeling. And I think that we can sort of get in our own heads about things a little bit and be taking ourselves out of experiences simply because we're not responding the way that we think that we might respond. And so there was something just sort of like funny and absurd to me about putting that phrase in these sparkly letters. Like, here it is. This is the goal. Like, this is what you're supposed to be feeling. It's right here.
Yeah. Outrageous. I do also want to ask you about the title of your exhibition, which is You, I, Everything Else. It sounds like, or not unlike, some of the text in your pieces and that have been drawn directly from real people have said. So that was a lead there. Can you tell us about how you selected the title for your exhibition?
Sure. And this is, it didn't come from the from The Bachelor. It actually is it's a quote from an artificial intelligence bot that was being developed by Facebook, or rather it's a pair of bots. Their names are Bob and Alice. Mm-hmm. And Facebook was developing these bots to eventually become customer service bots that humans could talk to work out technical issues that they were having. And in the process of developing them, these two bots were talking to each other and negotiating with each other. And at some point within that process or that experiment, things sort of started to go off the rails a little bit. And the bots started developing, I wouldn't say it's their own language necessarily, because they are still using English words, but they started developing their own way of speaking to each other that is not easily intelligible to English speakers. And so they are, so Bob and Alice are negotiating with each other and speaking to each other in these negotiations in ways that only they can understand. So that's something that one of the bots said to the other one in the process of that negotiation. And it became sort of evocative to me. I love, you know, I really recommend looking up the transcripts of their conversations. Mm-hmm. They're sort of like weird and poetic and satisfying. Oh,
there's a lot of repetition in them too.
A lot of repetition.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And it sort of, there was something nice to me about bringing in a little language that came from a non-human source as well, that, you know, I guess sort of looking at the way that I'm looking at this language and the way that these things, they have personal meaning because of, you know, because of how you're interpreting them. And that is something that we've developed, obviously. And I think that that's sort of interesting to read something that maybe comes from a source that doesn't have that kind of emotional background.
Yes, that gives us the emotions anyway.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say. Thank you so much for being here with me today, Allison, and to everyone in Portland. UI Everything Else will be open at Wolf Gallery through July 1st. Check it out. You have been listening to Art Focus with Amanda Clem on KBOO. KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tuesday, May 15th marks the 70th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were displaced from their homes for the creation of the State of Israel, creating the largest refugee population on earth, many of whom remain in exile generations later. KBOO will broadcast 5 hours of a 24-hour collaborative broadcast with stations in Canada, Europe, Africa, and Central America. Tune in from 3 to 8 p.m. on Tuesday, May 15th, for the Palestinian Nakba special on Radio Free Palestine.
Esto es Tania Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte informativo en español para el día 15 de mayo. Este lunes 14 de mayo, miles de palestinos protestaron a lo largo de la frontera con Israel, cuyo ejército disparó y causó la muerte de al menos 61 personas en Gaza y dejó un saldo de 2.700 heridos. Esto sucedió a escasos 80 kilómetros mientras Jared Kushner e Ivana Trump y las autoridades israelíes se preparaban para inaugurar la nueva embajada de Estados Unidos en Jerusalén. Durante el ataque, fueron utilizados drones de gas lacrimógeno y balas mariposa que explotan dentro de las personas. La mayoría de las personas fueron disparadas en las extremidades, pero se sabe de gente que fue impactada en la cara y el cuello. Los médicos del hospital de Shifa, el más importante de la capital de la Franja de Gaza, llevan más de 24 horas sin dormir. Con actos de acción directa, se llevó a cabo ayer en 35 estados y Washington una jornada de 1,000 arrestos debido al renacimiento de la campaña de los pobres, que fue originalmente encabezada por Martin Luther King hace medio siglo. Esta campaña exige una reforma de las leyes de derecho al voto y nuevas políticas para abordar la pobreza sistémica, el racismo, la devastación ecológica y frenar el militarismo. Una amplia coalición de líderes religiosos, sindicalistas, organizadores sociales, ambientalistas, estudiantes, artistas intelectuales y agrupaciones comunitarias participaron en esta ola de desobediencia civil no violenta. Autoridades de Estados Unidos han aumentado las auditorías en compañías para revisar si sus empleados